I feel that for writers everywhere, there is one ubiquitous fear, that of our work being stolen without our knowledge and used without our consent, aka plagiarism. And some people might say, oh, this only happens to indie authors or with students not wanting to write their essays. Well, it might surprise some of you to know that the queen of romance herself has been a victim of plagiarism multiple times. So let's talk about it. This week's episode is all about who really wrote that book you're reading now. Author, thief, or computer algorithm? Dun, dun, dun!
Hey there, romance nerds. I'm Jen.
And I'm Jackie.
We're two librarians from Nopal in upstate New York, and you're listening to Raging Romantics.
In this podcast, we like to think a little too deeply about romance books. If you're into theory, history, and raging about Romancelandia, then you should stick around.
Please be advised that some of the things we talk about may not be suitable for younger listeners. Content warnings for episodes are available in the show notes.
Jen, are you ready?
Oh, I'm ready.
All right.
Let's rage! Hey, Jackie, guess who has two thumbs and is scared of AI and came back to the podcast?
Jen!
This gal!
It got so loud it knocked the sound out.
Yeah, here I am. You want a real joke?
Yeah.
How does a young computer geek refer to his AI? Oh,
sorry.
How does a young computer geek refer to his AI-based girlfriend?
How?
Data bay. Didn't you miss this?
That should be a title for a romance book.
Data bay. I'm sure it will
Data
be.
Data bay.
Give it a year.
Yeah. Somewhere in indie.
Mm-hmm.
Indie pub.
It'll happen.
Yeah. Well, Jen, welcome back.
Thank you. It's been a long time coming.
I will speak for all of the romance nerds. We've missed you on the podcast.
You make me blush.
Thomas has been amazing, obviously. And yes, he was supposed
you,
to
Thomas.
Be here with us today, but he's El Sicko, so okay. He can keep his germs.
Yeah, I do not need to be sick right now.
Over there. No.
I don't need to be sick right
Neither
now.
Of us can afford to be sick at the moment. But Jen is back.
Here I am.
We're going to be talking about gossip to welcome her
Ooh,
back.
And you know I love gossip.
And one of her favorite things, artificial intelligence.
I was just telling my boss the other day that I really wish I'd been born earlier so I could be dead by the time things like AI come around.
Once again, you're such a Luddite.
I don't want to do it. I know it's like anti-librarian of me. Like most people go into librarianship loving technology or like being comfortable with it.
Yeah.
I do not like it particularly. Like I know what I know from as a child. That's like where I'm stuck.
That's fair.
Like,
you know,
don't
that's
get any
actually
more complicated.
Did I watch or listen? I don't remember where I got this, if it was on a podcast or whatever. But recently, I was told the information from some source that for a lot of people, our technology, like interest and ability, kind of peaks around eighth grade.
I could see that.
And especially like you and I, when we were in school, we had a computer lab that had like dial up, right?
Yeah.
That was our school internet.
I think too, we actually had a computer lab where we had classes.
Yeah,
same. I read that is not the norm anymore. They just kind of assume kids will get it.
Yeah. And that is also an issue because, you know, and this is a tangent. This has nothing to do with our episode. But while we're here, just to kind of put this in your ear to think of as romance nerds and librarians and friends of book people. A lot of the times we talk about the digital divide in the sense of elderly patrons not being able to understand or access technology either for cost or not ever having been taught it, right? Because they were, quote unquote, too old to learn it at the time.
Right.
There is currently a huge digital divide when it comes to the younger generation as well, because a lot of them think about how, you know, we're going to talk about like 13 and under has been taught to use touch phones.
Yeah.
They've been taught to use apps.
Mm-hmm.
They haven't been taught to use keyboards
right.
or to, you know, actively search something like how, and I keep saying like Jen and I, but like Jen and I, we were kind of that interesting cross section between old school researching on an actual physical catalog and using encyclopedias. But then we were also when internet was coming into play in research. So we were taught how to use both of those things. The younger generation now, they're just taught
like what? Wikipedia?
Hey, Siri, what is the size of a chicken's egg or something like that?
Okay.
They aren't necessarily taught how to access that information.
Right.
So there's a huge digital divide there as well.
And I think, too, just the media landscape is so much different.
Yes.
I mean, Google does not do the same kind of tasks it used to when we were like now it's like an ad generated business venue. You know, it's not like a genuine information gathering source necessarily. You got to be a lot more careful to avoid anything that's like up for profit.
Yeah. Plus now with AI on the scene, it's giving them the opportunity to not even have to do work necessarily. Right. Just they have to come up with a prompt and then that prompt is immediately answered.
Yeah.
Which brings us into today's episode.
Yeah, what are we talking about, Jackie? I've like been so out of the loop. So what's today?
We're talking about a couple different things. I figured we'd start with something that you love, which is gossip and drama. And we're going to talk about the queen of romance herself, Nora Roberts, who has unfortunately been embroiled in this drama for a very long time and repeatedly. And then we're also going to obviously talk about AI because, you know, we have to after I mentioned AI and how it interferes with plagiarism in romance publishing. Okay, so to take us back to one of our earlier episodes, episode 29, in fact, which was 2022, 2021, 2022, somewhere in there. It was a long time ago. Jen was talking about drama and gossip and tea in Romancelandia. And two of the authors she talked about, first off, Christine Sorolla, whose name we don't care if we mispronounce.
Because she stole all that stuff. So
she is the Brazilian author who plagiarized a crap ton, which is a metric term, of authors, including Courtney Milan, Tessa Dare, Courtney Chase, Nora Roberts, and over 30 other writers. In addition, Jen also talked about Janet Daly, who, yes, is one of the ones who first plagiarized Nora Roberts. And that's what we're going to talk about today. We're going to talk about the kind of the implications of that plagiarism on Romancelandia.
Because I know I just lightly brushed, but there was a lot more detail I could have gone into, but I was very focused on like this Christine case.
Yes.
That was, if you guys remember, it was massive and I would go back and listen to it.
Yes, go back and listen
to it.
It
was awesome.
Just as a brief brush up in case you're like, I don't have time. That's should listen to it first off. But second off, the queen of romance herself, Nora Roberts, had a case against Sorolla. And she was able to take legal action in 2019. She won her suit and donated all the damages from that suit to a literacy campaign in Brazil. This, unfortunately, was not the first time Roberts was a victim of plagiarism, as Jen talked about in episode 29, as I'm about to expand upon.
It's happened a couple of times.
Yeah, which for a prolific author, I mean,
it's so weird.
It's weird, but also one could argue it might only be a matter of time until someone tries to steal her work.
You know, I've never understood stealing Nora Roberts' work specifically because she is so popular.
Yes.
Like, I would think if I was going to be a plagiarist, which I hopefully never will be, cross my fingers, but if I was going to, I'd try to find a work that was less known.
Yeah.
And somebody who was not as rich as Nora Roberts, who has the spite and the money to go after these plagiarism cases.
Nora scares me.
Yeah.
She's like a scary mom.
It does. I don't know. It does surprise me. Maybe because she's Brazilian, she just assumed like people wouldn't have done it, or like they wouldn't have known the English to read her books, but they're translated.
Or because there's like so much of her work too.
Yeah. I guess you'd have to be like a diehard Nora Roberts fan to know, oh, that section is from her, the six books she ever published. Like, I guess I could see maybe taking the risk.
Yeah.
But I mean, so that's okay for Christine, but like Janet Daly had no excuse.
No, she did not. And you know what? Like we said, Roberts is not the woman you want to mess with, which is what Janet Daly found out in 1997.
That's what killed her, I bet.
Actually, it was heart surgery. Complications from heart surgery.
That's what did it. Okay.
Yeah. Although she had
because it broke her heart that she betrayed Nora.
Yes. Janet Daly was born Janet Harrodin in 1944, and in 1964, she married her much older husband, Bill Daly. Janet was only 20, Bill was 35. And Bill was a character all in himself, but we do not have enough time or brain space to talk about that.
Like a good character or a bad character?
A bad character.
Ugh,
he was a forceful manipulator, to put it lightly. Okay. Yeah. Well, he was a carnival caller and a carny for a while.
Well, I feel bad for Janet Daly for one thing.
Yeah. But you know what? Janet was always a reader. She used to tell this story about how she had a library card by the time she was four, and she like used it all the time, which, hey, that's good. And she said for a very long time that she could write a better romance than what she had been reading. And with her husband challenging her, she did just that. Eventually, she signed a deal with Mills and Boone, who at the time owned Harlequin, and published her first book, No Quarter Asked, in 1974. Daly wrote a total of 57 novels for Harlequin with their Presents line and a few others focusing on the American West. Indeed, over the course of her career, Daly would become known for her cowboy books with infamous titles such as Calder Pride, The Scrooge Wore Spurs, Castles in the Sand, and Riley's Woman. But it is her 1997 books, Aspen Gold and Notorious, that are the center of our focus today. Aspen Gold is the story of a Hollywood heroine who returns home to her family ranch in Aspen, where she must choose between her first love and a dashing fellow movie star. Notorious, also set on a ranch, is about a woman who eluded a first-degree murder charge. And at the same time, an owner of a competing ranch is trying to drive her out of her business using money and the trumped-up charges from her grandfather's death. That's when a quote-unquote soft-spoken stranger comes into town, and the two of them must confront years of mistrust together. Meanwhile, at the same time, Nora Roberts had a while back published her book Sweet Revenge in 1988. Good. That is such a good book. Like book. Classic mm-hmm. romance suspense.
I'm sure if I reread it today, I'd maybe be horrified by some of it. But like the whole yeah. premise is good.
Maybe some of like the personifications.
Yeah, maybe I would
pay like, little ladies, but
I would pick like maybe a different like because of the Arab.
Yeah. That, but it's still such a good story.
Yeah.
Like, just so suspenseful. Mm-hmm. So good. Surprisingly, thinking of it now, Nora was a relative newcomer on the romance scene mm-hmm. at the time. She had been writing for about 20 years, but only under Harlequin and other publishers. And in 1996, she reached her first ever hardcover bestseller, one of my personal favorites, Montana
that
Sky.
Was her first?
Her first hardcover.
Okay.
She had been on paperback bestsellers yeah. for a long time, but this was her first hardcover.
Okay.
Which
that's a good one too.
For a romance book to achieve a hardcover bestseller, that was wild. That the hard seller list at that time was predominantly ruled by Mary Higgins Clark, John Grisham, and Nicholas Evans.
Oh, I didn't think of it in that sense.
Yeah, so this was like one of the first strictly trad romances on the hardcover bestseller list.
That's a good one too.
Yeah,
I really liked so Montana Sky.
That was a good one. They made a Lifetime movie, but like one of those movies about it. It was a really good movie too. Roberts released Sweet Revenge on the heels of the most recent installment of her Scottish McGregor series, which is another really good series. I mean, it's Nora Roberts. They're all good. Sweet Revenge is the story about an apparent party princess / spoiled rich girl who is actually a cunning thief, hellbent on wreaking revenge on her father. It is then that she meets a man she trusts enough to tell her secrets to, only he has a secret of his own and turn about why he's trying to get close to her. Now, on the surface, these three books sound nothing alike. They follow similar tropes and have somewhat similar archetypes, sure, but they're novels. Novels thrive on tropes and archetypes, especially romance novels, let's be honest here. It wasn't until an astute reader read Notorious directly on the heels of Sweet Revenge that she noticed some striking similarities. So striking, in fact, it was as though entire passages from Sweet Revenge were then copy-pasted into Notorious. So, for instance, in Sweet Revenge, here's a little section of dialogue for you. I'm going to put some voices on. Be prepared. Talk to me. It was just a dream, as you said. You're hurting. He touched her cheek. This time, she didn't jerk away, only closed her eyes. You talk. I'll listen. I don't need anyone. I'm not going away until you talk to me. My career is not an audiobook narrator. Let's be clear with that. Okay. From Notorious. Talk to me, Eden. It was only a dream, just as you said. She kept her gaze fixed on the water glass. It was more than that. His fingers brushed her cheek, pushing back a strand of hair. She closed her eyes at the contact. You need to talk about it. I'll listen. I don't need anyone, she insisted stiffly. I'm not leaving until you tell me about it. So.
It's hard because, like, there's obviously similar beats.
Yeah.
I can see where in Notorious she tried to kind of switch it up by adding more not dialogue, but more
like
description.
Cues, yeah.
And cues. It's hard. I'd be interested to know where this happens in the plot line.
The plot.
Yeah. Because if it's like beat by beat, if she's like just stealing the kind of pieces from Nora Roberts.
Yeah.
I'm not defending Janet Daly. She definitely does steal like outright from Nora Roberts.
Yeah.
It's hard though in romance because it is so trope heavy.
Yeah. Like, I think it was just the fact that it's like word for word, it was only just a dream.
Yeah.
You're hurting. You need to talk about it. I don't need anyone.
It's hard because the hurt comfort stuff is so popular. And
yeah.
You always have like the stubborn heroine who doesn't want to talk about it. Like I could see it by accident.
Mm-hmm.
But knowing Janet Daly, I'm not like.
We'll get there. Good. Obviously, there is a striking similarity in these two cases, but these were not all. If it was just this, there would have been no case, but this was just the tip of the iceberg. This same astute reader noticed multiple other instances and, as it was the 90s, broke the news via an online blog. This spread like wildfire, and Nora eventually caught wind of it. She was disbelieving, in her own words. She knew Janet personally, even considered her a friend. Mm. But her husband and she owned a bookshop, so she had him pick up a copy of Notorious and bring it home that same day. As she said, quote unquote, "I asked him to bring home a copy of Notorious. Then I opened to the page the reader had cited. I can't describe what I felt in that moment. The shock, the grief, the sense of betrayal. I flipped through and that shock, grief, betrayal increased as I recognized more and more and more of my work in her book." What do you even do in that situation? We can postulate and think about what it's like to have our work plagiarized, but until it actually happens, we don't know how we would handle it.
You know, it sucks that it's her friend.
Yeah.
Like Christine, like, I don't understand, like, Christine Siria, whatever, for stealing from, like a powerful, popular author like Nora Roberts. I especially can't imagine stealing from, like, my friend Nora Roberts.
Like, they were more than just colleagues. Like, they were more than friendly colleagues. Like, they were two women in an industry that was really hard to get through. And they were bestsellers at this time. So they obviously were, like, friendly with each other. It's hard.
Sad. Yeah, it's hard. I don't know. It's just what a weird betrayal.
Roberts thankfully had the power of publishing and success on her side, so she acted immediately. She and her agent contacted Daly and her people to try and come to an agreement, and Roberts admits she isn't happy with what she agreed to. Quote, "I was asked to keep it quiet, to go through the manuscript for Notorious and remove my work. Because I knew her, because I'd never dealt with anything like this before, I agreed. Hint, never do this. I remember clearly sitting out on my front deck, crossing out line after line, scene after scene, and finally realizing it simply couldn't be done. As I realized that, my agent called. Pretty steamed. Daly's agent had contacted her, very excited. Daly's publisher wanted to go back to the press on the book, so could I hurry it up?" Now, obviously, this didn't happen, and Roberts called Janet directly to speak with her. According to Roberts, the phone call was tense and sorrowful, and Daly apologized profusely and with a lot of tears. Daly swore it was just the one time, just with Notorious, and that she was in a terrible headspace and that's why it happened. Except, when Nora got off that phone call, fully ready to forgive Daly, something told her to sit down and start going through Daly's other books. And, well, as she says, "When I got off the phone, I went to another of her books as my agent and I had decided I would read her stuff in case we found more. 5 minutes, I swear to God, 5 minutes after she'd tearfully sworn to me it had only been that one time, I found the second time in the second book." Obviously, Daly had done it before, held little contrition, and if proof were in the pudding, she would do it again.
Have you read Janet Daly?
I did back in the day. Like, the Calder series, I remember liking.
Do you remember her, like, how does her writing compare to Nora's? Is it, like, it's the similar. Same?
It's similar? Very similar. Okay. But I also, I have to wonder how much of that is because of the style of the time.
Just, yeah, like a trend.
Yeah, like, the sentence structure is very similar, like, some of the characterizations. But again, it's a novel. It's an industry.
Because I'm wondering if some of this was, like, a jealousy of Nora Roberts being a better writer.
Yeah.
Maybe because it's hard because even Nora Roberts' writing has changed so much. Like, yeah, reading a book from the 90s versus today is like a totally different person.
Yeah. Like, you can still tell it's the same author, but at the same time, it is different. Mm. Yeah. This was the tipping point for Roberts, who had trusted that Daly meant it when she said it was only one time. She felt lied and manipulated, lied to and manipulated. Indeed, this shows such a demonstrated lack of respect, not only for Roberts, but for the romance industry as a whole. And to make it clear, I only gave like two examples here. No, it was book after book, line after line after line. Like, the whole of Notorious, Roberts said you couldn't have written without Roberts' work predating it. It was pretty much like a blatant copy.
I forget. Like, correct me if I'm wrong. Are they the same publishers? They definitely have different agents. I'm just wondering, like, how nobody at the publishing house noticed.
That is an excellent point, because a lot of reporters pulled up the fact that not only had this book made it through Daly, made it through her agent, it made it through the publisher, acquisition, and multiple rounds of edits, and nobody noticed anything.
Yeah. And I imagine, like, the editors must also be fans of Nora Roberts. Like, it's just surprising it was a fan that noticed this.
I don't recall if these were both published under the same publisher. I could go back, but honestly, okay. It's really hard to look up Notorious because it was pulled from print, so it's hard to find.
Yeah, I guess it would have to be.
Yeah. But, I mean, it is a small industry, and they both came from Harlequin.
Yeah.
So there was a lot of discussion about how it was able to get through. But again, this was 1997. This was pre-Google at this point. So it wasn't so easy to plug a block in and an algorithm and be like, oh, this is the exact same thing, which is now what publishers do.
Yeah.
So there's none of that really checks and balances per se. It was much more easy. Let's just put it that way. Roberts sued Daly for plagiarizing her work and won her case, again donating all damages to the Literacy Volunteers of America. Janet did apologize, but Jen, it's time for some interaction. Would you read Janet's apology out loud for us?
Should I do it in a weird voice too?
Please do.
I recently learned that my essentially random and non-persuasive acts of copying are attributed to a psychological problem that I never even suspected I had. The plagiarism took place while I was under professional and personal stress. I have already begun treatment for the disorder and have been reassured that with treatment, this behavior can be prevented in the future. I can only apologize to Nora, who I've always considered a friend, and to my readers for any pain or embarrassment my conduct has caused.
Moment of silence for all of us dying of laughter. That was beautiful.
Thank you. I really wanted to just like embody Janet Daly and how I feel like she must have sounded back then.
For some reason, I feel like that is pitch perfect.
I have no idea. I've never listened to her.
Okay.
That might have been me being mean, but I mean, that's kind of a stupid apology.
Exactly.
You know what it reminds me of? It reminds me of that author we talked about before I left, the one who was super racist to all the authors of color. And then she came back with that apology of just like, oh, you know, my mental health really sucks. Yeah. And that's why I did this.
Oh, Kate Corrane.
There
yes.
you go. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, she obviously didn't plagiarize. She was just like going after people, but it's got like the same flow to it, but without the 2020 therapy talk.
Yeah, exactly. You know? I won't go too deeply into the psychology of apologizing, but just briefly think about the word choice here. Essentially random and non-pervasive acts of copying. Mm. This behavior can be prevented.
Yeah.
The plagiarism took place. Mm-hmm. By using this sort of phrasing, Daly is passive. Committing the sin of passive voice. Hey. For an author to use passive voice too? No. She's passing the blame onto a third party, the plagiarism, the disorder. It's mm-hmm. never about her.
And I could see maybe she was really stressed out. I mean, if she got a bad husband, maybe her home life wasn't that great.
And this isn't to discredit her mental health, because her husband was undergoing treatment for cancer. Her dog had passed away and her two brothers had just died.
Okay, so she was under a rough time.
She was under a lot of stress and it was trying for her. And she would have undoubtedly have had her publisher pushing her to write at least a book a year, if
I would
not two.
Think too, she would need the money.
Yeah.
If her husband had cancer.
And so if like, she was under contract.
Yeah. I could see it. It's just the apology is not great.
No.
And
it's
just
not.
It sucks too to betray your friend like that. Like, she didn't have another person she could steal from.
Right.
She couldn't have done a ghostwriter like Christina Serio.
You couldn't have just turned in a bad draft and been like, editing process, let's go. Mm-hmm. We can blame the publishing industry for some of that stress and, you know, some of the stuff going on with her mental health and all the stuff in her life. But that being said,
wrong actions though.
It's one of the most non-apology apologies I've ever heard.
Yeah.
In addition, we know that Daly had already lied to Roberts about it happening once. What's to make us believe
that's
she's telling the truth in this instance?
I mean, if she found books and books and books of it, like,
yeah,
sure, you can have depression for years and years and years. But like, at one point, do you just say, you know, I need to stop writing and take a break and go deal with some stuff in my life?
Yeah. And this is also not us speaking ill of the dead, because Daly did pass in 2013.
It's been a while.
She was an amazing author who had over 200 million copies of her books
sold.
Were
they her books?
Of books sold under her name, Patterson. And she was one of the pioneers of the modern romance genre. Mm-hmm. But that being said, this happened, and Daly and her publishers tried to push it under the rug. If it weren't for Roberts and her agent's persistence, this very well could have disappeared forever. Mm. It was this instance, in fact, that would inspire Roberts to immediately push back against Soroya 20-odd years later.
Yeah, so look at that. So in some ways, it's good it happened, because I feel like Nora Roberts was able to protect that many more people 20 years later.
Yes.
As opposed to her being the only one that was affected with the Janet Daly thing. Christina Siri, whatever. Like, she stole from a lot of people.
And I can't remember if it was, okay, there's a big difference in this number. If it was 806 million or if it's 806,000
that she won
in damages.
I can't
and then donated
anymore.
To.
Like
so Literacy Fund got a lot of money,
right,
which they need. Mm-hmm. So go donate to the Literacy Fund of America.
Yeah.
But to kind of talk about the implications of what this means for Romancelandia. This demonstration of plagiarism is bad enough, but it's the way that the industry and media reacted to it that really shine a light on how much has changed in Romancelandia and publishing in general in the last couple of decades. For instance, these two lines, next lines, were like headlines from news reports at the time.
I was wondering that. Like, I can't remember my own research 2 years ago, so sorry if I'm re-asking things I've said, That's okay. like how much did people care outside of romance? Was it like a big scandal that people were like making fun of us over, one of those? Yeah.
Heaving bosoms and throbbing loins are all very well, but if you really want to make a romance writer breathe heavily, try pinching her prose.
Ew.
And plagiarism, how can you tell when all this stuff sounds the same anyway?
Hey! What a jerk.
Exactly.
See, this is why RWA had a great award given to journalism who took romance seriously in their writing. This is why that happened, and that's why, again, it sucks. RWA is not what it was.
Also, RWA had Nora Roberts as the keynote speaker in 2007 about plagiarism. So, you know. But yeah, this was kind of like what the general consensus was at the time outside of those directly affected. They were like just pointing and laughing and being like, it's just romance. Why do you actually care? It doesn't matter that much. Oh my God, you're being over the top. So dramatic. Like, that was the general consensus. But we as savvy romance readers know that in general, romance books are not all the same. As I said at the top of the episode, novels and romance obviously thrive on tropes and archetypes. We even had a trope off last year. Tropes are going to be the same no matter what. And sure, some writers are going to sound the same based on their skill, their publisher, when they're publishing, all that sort of stuff. But short of blatant plagiarization, like here with Daly or with Soraya, we know that this stuff doesn't all sound the same.
Like, the journey should be different.
Yes.
Like, the tone should be different.
Yes.
Like, the different, maybe the solutions are the same, but like the feeling and the, like, the vibe of the story should be different.
Yes.
There's a lot of ways romance novels can distinguish themselves from each other.
To put it in a 2024 sense, the vibe was off.
Yes.
This is all just a gross generalization made by people who don't believe romance are real books, or by literary snobs. You know, they're kind of one and the same. But this does bring us back into the 21st century, into how plagiarism and copyright has changed with the changing publishing scene over the past 20, 30 years, and with the impact of emerging technologies. So, what is plagiarism? Plagiarism is formally defined as the unacknowledged use of another person's work. It's important to note that you cannot technically sue someone for plagiarism. It's hard to prove, as Jen talked about when we had the two examples side by side. I mean, yeah, it could, but it could also just be a coincidence, right?
If it wasn't for all of the rest of it, like, I probably would have done as like a good nature, like maybe an accident.
Yeah.
Or maybe just like very similar thought process, especially them being friends.
Exactly.
But I think if you have like piles and piles of evidence, then you can't be that good natured about it.
You could say it was quote unquote inspired by, or it was a fluke, a coincidence that these things sound the same. Rather, plagiarism can result in legal action if it's proven that one author infringed upon another author's copyright. So in Roberts' case here, she was able to sue both Daly and Soraya for copyright infringement. While plagiarism is the unacknowledged use, copyright infringement is the unauthorized use, meaning that plagiarism is the neglect of the use of a quotation, a citation, or a direct reference to, as to where a writer pulled the idea or quote from. However, copyright infringement is the non-permissible use. Either the copier didn't ask for or obtain permission through payment of a license, or with a contract that states permissible use or something of that ilk. This is where the legality comes into play. To put a little more plainly, plagiarism is an ethical issue. Copyright infringement is a legal issue. Copyright is when an author or an agent of a writer pays to cover the right to copy, i.e. the phrasing and narrative as pertained in a novel. It does not, however, cover ideas, only the specific expression of an idea. And Jen covered this in her Cocky Gate discussion, which was also in episode 29.
A lot of stuff has happened.
Yeah,
plenty of related to plagiarism and copyright.
Basically, words and individual ideas are not able to be copyrighted or protected by trademark unless they're used in a specific, unique sense or way. Is the work derived from, inspired by its predecessor with direct acknowledgement, or is it being derivative in the sense that it has stolen those ideas? For an interesting discussion of derivative versus stolen intellectual property, look up the 2023 Supreme Court decision in Warhol versus Goldsmith. This kind of really helped me understand a little bit more of how copyright is viewed in a legal sense. It's about a picture of Prince, if that inspires you at all.
Oh, I saw that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. The orange one. Yeah. Yep. So in the end, books, even though they contain a lot of similar words, tropes, characterizations, or plots, can be individually copyrighted because it is a unique demonstration of that trope, plot, etc.
So it's kind of like how Ruby Dixon can have Ice Planet Barbarians, and then other people can have similar, like, blue aliens and not infringe until they start saying like Ice Planet Barbarians.
Right. Mm-hmm. So it's, if you look at it, I hate math, but if you look at it like a math problem, mm-hmm. right? So Ruby Dixon, you have Kui plus blue barbarians plus Not Hoth plus humans plus aliens equals Ice Planet Barbarians. Mm-hmm. If you change out one of those factors, yeah, it's something completely different.
Right.
Right. It might be inspired by, it might be loosely derivative, yeah. but it's not necessarily copyright.
She definitely started a trend, but like she definitely can't go after anybody for doing like the hot version
yeah.
of the yeah. Ice Planet.
Which has been done.
Yeah. A bunch of people did like orange aliens on a fire planet.
Yeah. I'll put it in the show notes. I'll link one in the show notes because I can't think of the
with
cover.
Like a weird soulmate worm.
Yeah.
It was something like
it
that.
It was something very similar.
Yeah, but like she can't be mad about it because it's not Ice Planet.
I should also say that part of copyright infringement, like another huge part of it, is that you have to demonstrate the loss of revenue from this, which we'll talk about that in a little bit when it pertains to AI. But yeah, if Roberts can demonstrate that Soroya stealing her work was it caused her loss of revenue in mm-hmm. some way, sense or form, then yeah, that's like an immediate win. Mm-hmm. Roberts was able to prove that Daly blatantly plagiarized her copyright. It was a clear example of one author stealing from another's work and infringing upon her copyright without permission or acknowledgement. Daly's apology doesn't count for acknowledgement because, honestly, it was a forced non-apology and she had already made money off of her infringement.
Did she have to pay it back?
Yeah.
Okay.
That was the damages.
Oh, good. Okay,
yeah.
Just wondering.
Yeah, yeah. Yep. That's like Soroya having to pay it back. That was her damages.
Gotcha.
What's the just damage? Making sure. But then we must ask, what about when a novel or written work isn't written by human? Does it still count as copyright infringement or plagiarism if it's derivative without permission or acknowledgement? That's right. Put on your tinfoil hats and look out for Arnold. Raging Romantics is taking on the artificial intelligence debate. Artificially created books, that is, books developed through the generation of content via use of artificial intelligence, have been flooding the market. With tools like ChatGPT, Chapterly, Grammarly, WordTune, and so many more, it's easier than ever to have blocks of text spat back at you in a millisecond. And listen, just like any tool, AI can be good and bad. A hammer is a great tool for building things until someone uses it to bash another person's head in. AI is like that hammer. Hopefully it's not getting to the killing people part yet.
It'll come.
Anyways, AI can be useful to check your editing, to help you write more concisely or formally, to generate ideas with, to help you form coherent sentences from jumbled thoughts, or even to help you outline something which you already have the idea for. But there's also ripe opportunity for abuse of this tool. It's incredibly easy to give an AI a prompt and they can bang out a couple of sentences, paragraphs, chapters, even an entire book for you in a matter of minutes. Publishing, especially indie publishing, is unfortunately a place where these quote-unquote books propagate beyond sense. Within the past couple of years, really even since the end of 2022, the indie marketplace has become flooded with AI-generated books and content to the point where when you publish with KDP, Amazon's indie pub space, you have to specifically indicate whether any part of your book, whether it be cover, content, maps, images, etc., was created with AI.
If you use AI to make a cover, is that as bad as if you use it to write?
Oh yeah, we're going to talk about covers.
Okay, good.
Yeah,
my thought was like, oh yeah, like if I do a cover, who cares as much about AI? Like versus writing.
We'll talk about it.
Okay.
Don't worry, I have an example for you too to like see the.
Okay.
See it. And because this is a voluntary confession of whether or not the person used AI, when people use it, why would they have incentive to choose to tick that box, right? Especially if they're using AI for nefarious means. I love nefarious. It's such a good word. Nefarious. This brings up the question we're facing in the publishing world right now and in Romancelandia. Are these books that are generated by AI plagiarized, or that are generated using AI plagiarized? Are they copyrightable? Can we sell them as novels? Who owns AI-generated books or content? It's a wildly tangled web we weave. One of the leading questions we face against AI is whether or not AI-generated material is copyrighted. We have not yet reached an AI technology, thank God, that is wholly sentient and can create for itself. The human mind, for instance, is a creative machine. We are able to hallucinate wildly and create ideas that are wholly unique and pulled from 1,000 different inspirations at once. Due to the fact that no two people have the same lived experience, no two people then can technically generate the exact same thing without some form of collusion. AI, however, does not have this ability. AI is nothing currently besides an algorithm. The name is a bit of a misnomer because while AI does think, it has not yet mastered human intelligence. Thankfully, we haven't gotten to the iRobot part of the plotline yet. The AI algorithm uses everything it has at its disposal to then generate content. This content may seem unique and like nothing else, but what that AI has done is masterfully comb through billions upon trillions of results available to it to then create an answer for that prompt. And so, a lot of the times, that content that the algorithm has quote-unquote generated are pulled directly from other sources without permission.
Okay.
So, let's talk about covers for a minute. This is a great example. And we can poo-poo on somebody that we all know I like to read. For instance, we've been seeing this a lot lately with cover art. And since I know there are SJM haters out there, Sarah J. Maas haters out there, and because I've talked about her a lot recently, let's talk about the bad side of Sarah J. Maas. The UK paperback edition of House of Earth and Blood was announced for release in September, to be released in September of 2023. The announcement came out in May 2023. However, when the cover came out, there were a few artists who stood up and said, hang on there, that image is from Adobe stock images and has been marked as AI generated by Adobe.
Can't she afford a real artist?
That's the thing. So I'm going to put a link to this image. I mean, you look at it and it's blatantly like, okay. Oh, yeah, that's the same.
They really just changed the cover.
They
like
changed the colors. Yeah.
So it's like a wolf with kind of like this feather like fur.
Yeah, like, it's like really pretty.
It's pretty. And I guess the AI, like, it's got kind of like a rainbow oil slick sort of effect.
Yeah.
And the Sarah J. Maas cover, it's just red with like some blue leaves. Eyes. I mean, when I said like, oh, that's like a good option for some authors, I was thinking of like poor ones who were just starting out and didn't have money for things. But like Sarah J. Maas has money.
Yeah, exactly.
She can have like a very nice cover. Though I don't, is she picking the cover artists herself?
That is a good point. Mm-hmm. At this point, we have to say Bloomsbury
is doing it.
So Bloomsbury is the publisher.
I can imagine them cutting corners and being like, just do the cheapest.
So they used an image generated by AI, which had presumably also been pulled from another artist that was used to generate this image. So AI pulled this from an actual artist to generate for a best-selling fantasy novel that was sure to bring in thousands of pre-orders.
It's so weird to me. Still
and
used, like from a stock image pile.
At the time, Bloomsbury had a strict no AI policy.
Oh, that's funny.
The irony of that.
Okay.
But in reality, this is also somewhat false advertising. And it is directly harmful to the artist community. Not only has an artist been harmed by AI using their art to create the stock image, but then Bloomsbury robbed the chance for an artist to make a commission from that artist's possible creation of a unique, individualized commercial book cover. Mm-hmm. So the artist who was cheated by AI got loss of the deal because, you know, they're not being credited. But then Bloomsbury has also cheated potential artists out of what could be career-changing artwork.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's a lose-lose for
Except
everybody
for
but
the
AI.
Publisher.
And to bring it back to more actual writing, Jane Friedman is an author who has brought the AI issue to light in the Amazon publishing scene and how it's harming the authors that AI uses and abuses. In 2023, she noticed that there were multiple books, and this is not solely, like, she's not a single instance. She's just one of the most vocal about it. There were multiple books appearing with her name on them that she had never written. It turns out that someone was using an AI generator to rip words off of Friedman and other authors to then generate a book that met publishing guidelines on Amazon, which, again, is a self-check system. They were then pumping out multiple titles all at the same time under Friedman's name. The issues? There's a few. Firstly, Friedman isn't getting paid for these books. Whoever uploaded them is the one getting paid, even though Friedman's name is on them. Second, this could be defamatory in nature. We all know, as smart romance nerds, that AI isn't always right.
You have like a Nazi AI writing stuff.
Yeah. Also, you can generally tell when AI has generated text because there's just something about the tone and the sentence and the word choice that isn't natural. It's like definitely like glued together bits by a robot, right? Again, there's none of that human cognition. There's none of that human sense of the world that is guiding how they're putting things together. There's no, you know, like when you write a speech or when you write something, you're always told to read it out loud because when you read it out loud, it's going to help it make more sense. It's going to help it seem more natural. Right. AI can't really read things out loud or it doesn't have the cognition to understand.
They're just gluing pieces together from other people's
work. I just realized we're helping AI by making this episode because we're pointing all the bad things out. This episode cannot be used for AI purposes. Put that disclaimer at the top. And with AI art, there's always that weird like sixth finger or something that clues you in, right? So these AI generate... Go ahead.
Sorry, I was just going to say, just to point that out, it does depend, though, on your savvy.
Yeah, exactly.
Because, like, some of the writing things I could kind of pick up on, but then people will have like, oh, look at this terrible AI artwork. And I'm like, I don't see it. Like, because I'm just not really used to looking. Ugh, God, I sound so uncultured when I'm like,
No, that's a good point,
but,
too.
You know, like, so when you say like, oh, it's so obvious, it's so easy. Like, I've definitely seen some of those memes of like, look at that. And I'm like, what am I looking at? It's a picture. Ooh,
that's
it's
the
so
thing,
nice.
Too, is that it's getting more and more difficult to recognize when something is AI. Like, the writing is still there because, again, there's that human cognition that can't be beat.
It depends. I have to actually read it. And sometimes it makes sense to me or I just assume, oh, they just didn't edit it.
Right.
But then there's, like, I saw a really good example from cookbooks.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the cooks, like, some of the cookbooks they've been writing have been wild.
Yeah.
That do not make any sense whatsoever.
Yeah. There was an instance I was reading that was from an AI company and they were like, yes, AI is creating all these new recipes for this drink bar that was open. I was like, well, first off, is it actually a new recipe or has it just scanned hundreds of thousands of other drink recipes and then kind of conglomerated something together that does make sense? Mm-hmm. But again, like you said, there are instances where it's like, and this time use the flesh of one human male plus the flesh of one goat aged 7 years old. And you're like, that's not, no.
The one I saw was like slow cooker recipe. So it's like, what is slow cooker?
Oh.
Slow cooker is a ceramic coated cooking device left unassisted for hours.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's weird. Yeah, like that I can see.
Yeah.
The art, though, I'm still saying, like, I am not good at picking out art. Like, that wolf that you just showed me, like, I would have assumed that was, like, a normal artist thing. You know?
There is,
I'm just not talented at picking it out. It's like with that Kate Middleton thing.
Yes,
like,
the photo.
Look at all the Photoshop stuff. And I'm like, what Photoshop?
It's like, it's hard to tell unless you actually like have somebody point it out to you. I'll have to point this cover out to you later, Jen. There's a new one called Gothicana, which is like a dark romance, like dark academia something. But the cover is so blatantly AI, but you wouldn't know it. First time looking at it, but the more you look at it, it's like, wait. And then parts of it are, again, like Sarah J. Maas, directly pulled from stock images.
So it seems like it's very easy to trick the majority of people if they're like me.
Because I'm exactly
not, even as a librarian, I'm not that knowledgeable about it.
And as time goes on, AI is getting better at mimicking.
So it'll be harder for even me to notice or for you to notice.
Exactly. So that's just one of those things that we have to look out for as savvy romance nerds. So... Again, to get back to Friedman of how it can be defamatory. Friedman. No, that was a good tangent. How it can be defamatory. These AI-generated books using Friedman's name, they could be harming her reputation as a writer. Because, like I said, that writing, there's always something off about that writing, right? So somebody might buy a book being like, oh, Jane Friedman, I love her work. And then they read it and it's that slow cooker, how to slow cook in a cooker, like that.
Yeah.
That is bad writing, which means bad reviews. Or returned books, which then could lead to loss of revenue.
I imagine the subject, too, is probably wildly different from whatever she talks
about.
You know?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And finally, if the AI is farming from Friedman's work, then that is, in fact, copyright infringement because money is being made off of work that is mimicking and pretending to be Friedman. It's like with fan fiction, how people who write fan fiction can't make money off of fanfic.
No, don't do it.
It's the exact same thing.
Yeah.
That's the exact same thing. It's just it's a robot or it's a computer algorithm that is farming words and smacking words together that might have a lick of sense. In an open letter from the Authors Guild on the topic of AI, authors such as Friedman, Roberts, Patterson, King, Baldacci, and more have all said, quote, generative AI technologies heavily rely on authors' language, stories, style, and ideas. Millions of copyrighted books, articles, essays, and poetry serve as the foundation for AI systems, yet authors have not received any compensation for their contributions. The output of AI will always be derivative in nature. AI regurgitates what it takes in, which is the work of human writers. It's only fair that authors be compensated for having, quote, fed AI and continuing to inform its evolution. Our work cannot be used without consent, credit, and compensation. All three are a must.
And that'd be so interesting to know, like, how much to pay and who to pay.
Yeah.
Like, if you're stealing writing from Nora Roberts, how do you even pay for that?
Well, let's say, so you use AI to farm a passage, and it pulls from Roberts, Patterson, Stephen King.
That's a wild book. You like just started a new genre.
Also, those are like three of the top earning authors out there. Mm-hmm. There's no way you're going to afford that. Yeah. So it's just like one of those things that.
We don't have answers, just questions.
Which is good because we're going to have a discussion over some questions right now. We have two questions that I came up with that I was like, I think we need to talk about. Should AI books be sold as traditional books?
No.
Okay. Yeah, that's what I was thinking
obviously.
Too.
I think it really reminds me of the Christina Sirio thing, because her claim was she had to use ghostwriters because she didn't have time, but she had all these amazing ideas, so she needed the ghostwriters to write them for her. That's basically what you're making this AI stuff doing.
Yeah.
I mean, if... It's great if you've got a really cool idea, but if you're not going to sit there and type it yourself, first of all, I don't know why you expect me to care about it. And two, it's cheating. Yes, it's just cheating. I don't care about your dumb book if you're just like, I've got this great concept of slash King slash Nora Roberts slash Balducci book, and this is, he's going to go after the girl, and it's going to do this. Like, I don't care. Write the stupid story.
Yeah.
I write the stupid story. I would get really mad to read a whole book and find out, oh, it's like you just inputted some stuff in like a little chat box and it spats. And like, no, write the book.
I do wonder if eventually we will get to the point where, because there are so many of these books, it's going to create its whole own genre.
Yeah.
It's going to be like artificial intelligence books, which scares me. This is where I'm going to put on my tinfoil hat.
No.
And I'm going to be like, if we're using AI to create its own whole genre, then that is a computer algorithm that is creating something that we are then paying money for.
Yeah, that makes me mad. Like, you remember how some of the old controversies of Amazon were things like teams of authors writing under one name to come out with like 20 books a month?
Alexa Riley.
Yeah, like author farms or some of these other weird things that were happening kind of in the background. That, like, the pales in comparison to like a machine just churning it out like instantly. Like, I'd be so mad if Alexa Riley was secretly an AI this whole time.
Yeah.
It's got the A.
Hey, it could be. Let's perform a little test. Let's go to ChatGPT, which I have used for work. It's a tool. Yeah. I use it as a librarian.
I get that, but I don't want to read.
Exactly.
Like in my spare time, I don't want to read a computer generated thing. I don't know why. It just makes me really mad.
Let's start my timer.
Okay.
Ready? Timer or stopwatch. There we go. And what should I give it as a prompt?
What do you mean?
Like write me 3,000 words for the first chapter of a book, of a romance book. Okay, ready? Write me 3,000 words for the first chapter of a romance book. Ready?
Yeah.
And hang on, I gotta click them at the same time and start.
Like, you didn't even give it any prompts. You weren't like, give me dark romance.
Title. Whispers of Spring.
Oh, shut up!
And we are writing chapter one, A New Beginning. Jasmine's heart's life was at a crossroads.
Oh, Jasmine! And it's
much
spring.
Like the sleepy town of Evergreen Springs, where the river bifurcated. See, that's what I mean.
So
bifurcated.
Mad.
Who would use bifurcated in a romance book?
At least you can tell, but just like. I don't want to be overdramatic, but it really degrades the genre. Like, it's hard enough that there's all these people to like, oh, it's so easy to write this, blah, blah, blah. And then you've got a computer spatting this stuff out.
Oh, Alex Carter. That's a ripoff of James Patterson, Speak of the Devil.
Alex Cross.
Yeah. Yep. Mm-hmm. Anyways, we're going to keep talking while this writes, and we're going to see how long it's taking it. We're at 45 seconds. Oh, we have dialogue. I used to think that some wounds never heal, he confessed. But then I realized that it's not about forgetting the past or the pain. It's about finding the courage to move forward. Who would write that in a first chapter? That's like
That's like climax.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Unless he's in therapy in the first chapter.
We should ask it to write a sex scene.
Oh, no! No! It'd be so horrifying.
I'll experiment with that later and let you know what it comes back with. Oh, there we go. We are end of chapter one, 1 minute and 15 wow. seconds. 3,000 yeah, words.
Mad. I don't know what it is. I don't think it's good for the genre. I feel like anybody who tries to argue like, oh, that this is good for like disabled people or this is good for this, blah, blah, blah. Like you have all the time in the world to write the book.
Yeah.
You can talk into one of those converters if like typing is an issue. Like I can't, like I'm sitting here trying to think if there's a reasonable reason to write a romance novel with AI and I'm not coming up with one.
The only way
yeah.
is if you used it as a tool. If so you like use it later. As a jumping off point.
I
so
guess,
if you have still... a prompt, it's there still has to be some sort of mm-hmm. unique human like input, yeah. right? Like you have to either come up with a prompt and the majority of the work yourself. So like I just fed it a prompt of write me a romance book yeah. and it plopped
real
off.
Real genre.
Right?
Yeah.
So real what genre. If I was like, write me real genre.
Real genre, man.
What if I was like, okay, write me a contemporary romance novel set in Montana in the mountains where there is a plane that crashes and the guy saves the woman from the plane crash and then
no,
they
no, because you're just writing the adult version of Hatchet.
Yeah. Also, that is they made a movie about that with the woman who was from Titanic, Kate Winslet. There was a movie Kate Winslet that was based on a book with Idris Elba. Yeah.
So see, it's already done. So yeah. No, it's dumb. Don't use AI. Just write it yourself.
Exactly.
Just do that.
Use it to help you mm-hmm. become a more concise writer. Use it to help you
for professional stuff.
For professional things. Yeah. Use it as a tool. Do not use it as the resource.
I am saying as a romance reader, if I find out I read a book that you wrote with AI, I will be very mad. And I will want my money back. Like, I'm not one of those people that is like, oh, let me go get my refund from Amazon. I will do that.
So second question, I'm going to skip the one I wrote because we know the answer. Are AI books plagiarism? Yes, yeah. They are. Yeah, in the end, they are. Well, how about if AI eventually does get to the point where it does have that human cognition, which is scary to think about, mm-hmm. who should get paid for AI books?
I mean, if they can figure out what authors the machine learned from, I would say they get paid.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't care about your idea. If it was that good of an idea, you would have written it.
What scares me about that idea is if it gets to that point, publishers could then just farm
just get
AI
rid of authors, totally.
Generations, mm-hmm. generated ideas, yeah. and just get rid of the authors. And then publishing houses would become just writing AI. Houses.
No.
Which is terrifying.
Yeah, I don't think that's a good idea. I'm just thinking of what capitalism is like. No,
that's like
you.
1984 of the publishing world with like authors being mm-hmm. the Orwellian hero who's trying to like fight against mm-hmm. the machine, literally in this case.
I know I came into this episode being like, I hate AI, and that's mostly just because I don't like tech. Like I've been scared like for a long time of things like deepfakes becoming so real, like you can't trust anything anymore, and like certain aspects of that. I know there's a place for AI, and I've had these talks with other librarians about like, yeah, it's really useful for all these different things. I refuse to accept any of that for creative writing.
Yeah.
Like
creative
writing.
Is that's a why good I said creative. Way of putting it. Mm-hmm. Yes. Anything that is creative that has to rely on that like human cognition. Yeah. I keep saying that, but I think that is the clarifying point mm-hmm. of anything that you have to use that human imagination for. There should be no generation with AI.
I think at that point, it's like, what's the point?
Exactly.
You know, if Nora Roberts is going to put Montana Sky into AI instead of write herself, like, why do I care?
Which we know Miss Roberts would never
would
do.
Would never, no. But if it's like, or like if Ruby Dixon could only write Ice Planet Barbarians through AI, I would be like, screw you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like, that's not what I want to read.
Yeah. I want to know what you thought and believed and felt if I'm going to spend my money and my time reading this.
I like that sentiment. Mm-hmm. Yes, we read the books for the story, but we also read it for the author a lot of the times.
Yeah, because I think, like, I want to know your tone and your voice, because that's what makes me read a book, really, especially in romance, where, like, the tropes are so used so frequently. And, like, you can read, like, that's how I can read, like, the same mafia story 20 times in a row. You know, because like the voice is different. There's like different situations. The feel is different. Like I'm more like want something lighter. I want something darker. I want whatever. It's the author. It's not even so much like, ooh, there's a mafia boy.
It's our auto-buy authors.
Yeah.
Auto-buy. Like Leigh Bardugo is coming out. Well, by the time this episode, she'll just come out with her new one. Yeah. It was an auto-buy. I pre-ordered it. Yeah. I pre-ordered a special edition because I know I love her work. I know I trust her stories. Yeah. And I know it's going to be fantastic.
I have not read all of the Dragon books from Ruby Dixon, but I own them all.
One day. One day.
I reread them when I was gone. That's coming. I was like prepping to read the next one that I was like, it was good. And then instead I wanted to read Christine Phan.
That's fair. We'll talk about that in a minute. But, well, I think that's a good place to end this long, windy, hopefully it made sense discussion. Hopefully it provoked some thoughts.
Yeah, because it's coming. I mean, it still feels so new. I was thinking, like, with some of the questions you were asking, like, this was not a problem even a year ago.
No. Like, this is so all within new. The past, like, 16 months. Mm-hmm. And that's the thing with technology. It's the fast. Point we're at, it's, like, ever-changing, ever-developing.
I hate it. I don't like it.
Yeah.
I want to live in a rock or something.
And with each mistake it makes, it is going to learn and it's going to spew out 10 things that are better that don't have mistakes.
But write your own books.
Yes, write your own books.
I'm not buying it otherwise.
If you have questions about AI and AI technologies, I've put some resources in the show notes for you. You can also always reach out to us at ragingromantics@nopal.org. And Jen, I'm going to turn you down for this next part. Oh, wait, no. First off, I have to ask. Have you been reading anything?
No.
Okay, that's fair.
Well, I did a little bit. I've been like going back to my January episode where I was talking about how to read stuff. I'm hoping I mentioned rereading. I'm pretty sure I did.
I think so.
Because I was just really in the mood to go back and reread Christine Phan like the last month, just with the stuff that I was dealing with. And it's been really nice.
Good.
Like, it's so weird because in some ways she's aged so badly and I still can't really read new Christine Phan because it just doesn't
work.
But,
like, the old is gold.
Yeah, the old is really good. Even, like, the stuff that I'm a little bit like, I wish you hadn't done that. Yeah. But, like, the voice is there, the vibe is there, the aesthetic is there. The stuff that I loved reading it the first time around is still there. Even if some of the, like the jokes didn't age great or, like, I love the one book, but the one book, she has like the 16-year-old meet the life mate that's like 1,000 years old and she's starting to feel things and like he licks her skin and I'm like, no, Christine, don't do that now.
Oh,
I mean, it's reading it now in 2024 is a very different experience than like 2000, whatever, when I was a teenager.
Yeah.
Like, as a teenager, I was like, oh, I thought that's so great. 33-year-old Jen, I'm like, get away from that girl. Like,
creeper.
Stuff like that
is
very different. And that's actually been another nice thing of, like, keeping my mind off things. I like kind of looking at the difference in how she's changed and how society's changed. And again, being like, this is still really nice. Like, I still love the life mate thing and the writing and the stuff it invokes.
Nice.
So that's how I've been reading. I'm still behind my book goals.
That's okay.
But you know what? Since I am reading them almost cover to cover, I'm skipping the fight scenes because I don't care.
Yeah, that's
really
fair.
But I'm still counting them to my Goodreads because I'm like, I'm like revisiting my youth.
Nice.
Which is weird because I should not have been reading this in high school.
Yeah, I've been thinking about that a lot lately with some discussions going on. I'm like, what's done is done. We turned out okay.
I mean, I'm going to say this totally as my own opinion, and this is so far beyond AI, you probably cut it later, but I don't think it's that bad for romance to be read at a certain age, because I look at the statistics of when people start looking at porn, and like, if I am curious about something, I'd much rather read it in a romance novel than Google it.
Maybe we'll talk about this in the minisode instead of what we were going to talk about, because there's like, a lot of stuff going on with that exact sentiment now.
But it's so hard to say that because I completely understand why parents want to protect their children.
Exactly.
But at the same time, like, if they have a phone, you've lost the battle.
Yeah.
Or if they have friends.
Yeah.
With older siblings. You know?
Especially in the world we live in today.
Yeah, I should not have said that because I'm not a parent and I don't want to get in trouble. And but again, thinking about the Christine Phan thing, I'm like, that's what Moms for Liberty should be mad about, is this 16-year-old like getting licked by like 1,000-year-old.
Yeah.
Not in a bad way. She was burnt and he's got like healing saliva. But it's still like, she is 16 years old.
For romance reasons.
And like in the book they keep saying, oh, but you know, like biologically she's mature enough. Like her life experiences
have made
her mature enough.
Why did we always
way.
Say that when we were younger? We were just making excuses for ourselves.
Exactly. Yeah.
That's all we were doing.
So like that stuff did not age well, and I would have been like, please, if you redo it today, maybe like 18.
Yeah. At the minimum. Even then, I'm like, I cannot read 18-year-old heroines
anymore.
I mean, like a minimum of 22.
Yeah.
That's like as low as I can go.
That was way far off from what you meant. But that is what I've been reading, and I've been really enjoying it. And I've kind of hit my limit, though, because I'm getting to the older, like the newer Christine Phan, where I love her. I will love her forever, but I just can't read the new stuff.
Yeah, that's fair.
I can't read the new dark stuff. Her other series are pretty good, but there's something about like the 21-year-old life mate sounding 60.
Yeah.
I can't do it.
Well, that's direct upon the author. But anyways, I have started, again, Leigh Bardugo's newest one, which is called The Familiar. Mm-hmm. It is a historical, magical realism. It's set in 16th century Spain. It's about Jewish persecution, and it's about Jewish magic.
Oh, cool.
Okay. And specifically, the heroine is a scullery maid who has magic that is related directly to her Jewish heritage. Mm-hmm. And it is discovered that she uses it, but nobody knows that she's Jewish because at this time it was the Spanish Inquisition and nobody expects the Spanish Inquisition. Mm-hmm. And so she ends up competing in a royal tournament to be the king's magician.
Yeah.
And it's got romance in it somewhere. I haven't gotten to that point yet, but I'm very intrigued by the hero because he's like, he reminds me of that one character in Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
I never watched it.
Angel. He reminds me of Angel in Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
I've seen GIFs.
Okay. Yeah. Well, he's super pale.
The brown haired guy.
Oh, maybe I have the wrong one then.
No, because Spike was the...
Spike. Was he reminds me of Spike. Sorry, not Angel. He reminds me of Spike. See, I'm...
See, even I know that as a person who didn't watch Buffy.
Anyways. Jen, I'm going to turn you down for this next part because I know it's been building up for a month now. Are you ready? What do we always say?
Wait,
John! I'm so glad I turned you down for that. All right. Bye, guys. Is it working?
Probably shouldn't have had so much chocolate. Now my mouth is like moist.
Moist.
I can't use that word.
Romance podcast. Moist. I should turn us down. Apparently.
Is ASMR still cool? Should we do an ASMR episode one day?
How would we do a romance ASMR, Jen?
Because we would lean in and whisper like this.
Wait, I need a floppy book.
And it would be the verbal equivalent of when you leaned across from me, like Lissa Kate Adams said.
Could just be a background of floppy books the entire time. Not very good floppy book, though. I need a better floppy book. How about you? The Art of Fear. No, nonfictions just don't flop like
that. No. Oh, is this on?
Yeah.
Oh, oops. I guess I should get serious then.
Oh, serious. it's good to be back.